Hello and welcome to the Entrepreneurs Chat, a podcast brought to you by SG Kleinwort Ambrose. I'm your host for this series, James Hurley, Assistant Business Editor at The Times. From startup to sale and everything in between, building a business is never plain sailing, and in this series we go behind the scenes reflecting on some of the highs and lows that come with growing a business. Today I'm joined by Joanna Jensen, founder of Child's Farm, a leading child and baby skincare brand.
And when you're in that situation and you've run out of cash, don't sit there and think, oh, I'm not going to say anything because, you know, I'll put off my existing investors. Go out there. There are angel investors who specifically invest in distressed businesses. And I went straight to a broker who did this. And I went straight to him and I said, help.
Joanna started making her own skincare formulas back in 2010 to help soothe the skin of her youngest daughter, Bella, who had eczema. Last year, she sold 90% of the resulting company, Child's Farm, to PZ Cousins for £36.8 million. The 12-year journey in between has been, to use Joanna's own word, madness. Over to Joanna to tell us all about it. You built one of the UK's leading child and baby skincare businesses despite having no experience in the relevant areas. I'm thinking things like consumer goods, branding, packaging, retail, even chemistry. Take me back to the beginning and explain how it all began.
Well, I mean, it's like a lot of these things. You have a situation in your life and you want to resolve it, and there was nothing that could help me resolve it. I was an eczema sufferer as a child. And so when my youngest was born in 2008 with atopic eczema, I was shocked to discover that nothing had improved in terms of our skincare availability, certainly for little ones. And it really was the fact that there was nothing there and I needed something desperately for her. And if I needed something desperately for her, there were other people that needed it desperately for their children. So it was a sort of very much needs must with absolutely no experience, as you point out, in any of this area other than an absolute fascination and a real interest in a natural non-medicinal ointments and treatments. Because as I say, I had eczema as a child and I've always had sensitive skin. So I've always been very interested in solutions, natural solutions for sensitive skin sufferers.
When you started the company in 2010, had you been harbouring a desire to start a business, to become an entrepreneur, or was it purely because you wanted to solve this problem?
I mean, the word entrepreneur I find fascinating because actually it's a French word and it means risk taker. So when I was sort of 16, I made a load of products and sold them in my grandfather's antique showroom. And, you know, went on, had a French polishing business, and indeed in my early 20s had an interior design business. But I think, you know, for me, setting up this business was the absolute entrepreneurial thing because of the amount of risk I took. But I had no desire really to set up another business. I was quite happy doing what I was doing. And having had both my children quite late in life, I just wanted a rest to enjoy them. But circumstances changed. I had this real need because of Bella's skin, couldn't find what I needed. And I thought, you know, damn it, I'm going to do it myself.
We'll talk a little bit about your background in financial services later on. But first of all, can you tell me a little bit about what the early years of Child's Farm were like? So as I said, you started the business in 2010, didn't you? And I think it took about 4 years to get into major retailers, to get some listings in the likes of Boots and Waitrose and others. What were you doing in that period? Did it take longer than you expected to get traction, or was it a sort of purposeful building of the company that meant it took a while to get seen in major retailers?
Well, I think any founder knows you have to have patience and resilience in spades when you go about setting up a new business. And for me, I mean, I registered the business in 2010 and we spent 2011 working on the formulations, the packaging, making sure that everything was as it should be, and then started selling online in 2012. We had some early victories, which were Amazon and actually Ocado in 2013. But to get into main retailers, so the big four grocers, Boots, Superdrug, you know, that's a real slog because they have to take a risk too, because you're a startup business, you've got no, you know, you've got to prove that you're going to remain solvent. You can't just deliver some product and then hope you've got enough money to deliver them, you know, the following month. Plus, they have their own different terms of business. And this is something that really I was completely naive about at the beginning, is You know, people don't pay you when they get the goods. You know, some people's payment terms are something like 90 days. And that's a long time to go without payment for stock that you've sold. Ironically, the big businesses sort of have 30-day payment terms, but SMEs are really stretched to the wire. It's another one of those, I suppose, the unfair things about being a small business is that you have to prove yourself before anyone gives you any credit.
And how did you go about doing that? How did you prove that you were sort of worthy to work with major retailers and indeed you could, you know, smooth out that cash flow and survive and be solvent through that process?
I basically did a deal with my amazing manufacturer, a guy called Tom Allsworth, ran a business called Medichem, and they were contract fillers, contract manufacturers. And he basically bankrolled me over the initial going into the initial bigger retailers. He totally believed in the brand. He knew we had the listings, the first listings we got in Boots and Waitrose in 2014. I was short of cash and he, bless him, he agreed to help me in the interim because, of course, he knew he was making the product so he could deduct whatever needed to be done. And so we ran the business initially through his account, which was a godsend.
And have you got any tips on finding a relationship like that or developing it? Because it sounds like you might not have actually been able to get this business to the point it's at now if you hadn't have had that support, because financing cash flow issues with retailers is a huge problem for businesses of all sizes, and certainly a lot of small businesses don't survive when that happens. So how do you find and develop a partner that's willing to help you do that?
Well, I mean, just ask a lot of questions, ask other people who've done it, who they've used for contract manufacturer. There are some real gems out there, but like many things, you have to do a lot of sifting to find them. I was very lucky. I was recommended to Tom through a friend of a friend. He understood what I was trying to achieve. He himself is an entrepreneur, and he actually set up Revolution Beauty, and he'd done a myriad of things as well. So he really understood what I was trying to do. I think it was a privately owned contract manufacturer. I think that was key. I think if it's a sort of big business, you're going to find this a lot more tricky to try and get someone to back you. But everything in business, and this might seem quite bizarre because we live in a world where people do things via email, but relationships, when you are an SME, the relationships that you have with your suppliers, the people that you work with, your retailers are absolutely key. They cannot be nameless and faceless, because when you do need someone's help, you need to have a depth of a relationship that can stand that ability for you to go in and ask. I think what frightens me currently is so much is done, and this is sort of part of COVID as well, is not done face to face still. And that means that you don't have a depth of relationship that you would do otherwise. Just going out for a cup of coffee with someone, going out for lunch with them, going to their premises, showing that you can make that effort. I mean, it used to take me 2.5 hours to get to Tom. I would go there every single month. Sometimes I'd go there 3-4 times a month, because my relationship and anyone's, if you're in FMCG, anyone's relationship with their supplier, their contract filler, is the most important relationship that you have. If you have no products, you can't sell anything.
So great tips there. And that's a strong relationship, but not every relationship that you've had in the business has worked, has it, Joanna? Can you tell us a little bit about what happened in 2014 when you thought you'd secured an investor that was going to make a multi-million pound injection into the business? And I understand they pulled out at the last minute. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, so we were sort of courted by this investor for about 6 months, and you know, there was always this doubt in my mind because we didn't fit their investment criteria. But the principal was absolutely determined that he was going to make this investment. And so we jumped through all the hoops. Lawyers were involved. And as you can imagine, when you're an SME and you're getting big lawyers involved, that's a lot of expense. And we had these listings books in Boots and Waitrose. And 4 days before we were due to sign, they pulled out. And I had to say all credit to the other members of the business who I still stay in touch with, who were super, super supportive. The individual themselves was not. And they helped me navigate this real moment of total distress. I can't tell you. It's sort of, As you alluded to earlier, I was just about to leave my home. I'd been going through a divorce and I had two small children, and I had a month to find somewhere to live and also needed to get this investment in. And that was one key part of the jigsaw. When they pulled out, I literally felt like my whole world was crashing down around my ears. And again, this is part of being an entrepreneur, a founder, is the first thing I did, I was told on the telephone, I went straight to the train station, got on a train to London, just turned up at their office. And I said, talk me through this. Talk me through why you've done this. I'm just in total shock. And actually, we ended up having a call with Boots. And his opening gambit was, right, well, Joanna's got no money, so this business is obviously just about to go bust, but you've got the listing. What do you want to do? Talk about kicking someone when they're down. And I arranged to go and see them the following week. And I drove the 3.5 hours to Boots thinking, I'm buggered, I'm buggered, I'm buggered. But, you know, I'm always thinking on my feet. And I thought, you know, I'll come up with something. I don't know what, but let's just see. Let's just get a sense of the situation and I'll play it by ear. What I had not considered was that I was going to walk into a room full of senior representatives of Boots who turned around to me and said, Joanna, we love your brand. We love you. What can we do to help? And I was absolutely blown away. And I mean, how I didn't burst into tears on the spot is beyond me. But I thought, I don't really want to have a retailer investing in my business. So I don't know. I mean, in hindsight, you think, what was I thinking and why did I say it? I said, you are absolutely amazing. It's all in hand. It's all in hand. I've got an investor lined up, but thank you. Everything is business as usual, and don't worry, we'll be there on time. And actually, it's because I had spoken to Tom at Medichem and he had said, don't worry, I'll look after you. It was a temporary fix, but it gave me a breathing space to know that I could actually find another investor to help me out. But I mean, talk about one of those heart-stopping moments where you actually think you're going to be physically sick. And, you know, in that circumstance, there wasn't really any logic other than the fact he turned around to me and he said, you don't fit our investment criteria. And you don't go through a process with someone for 6 months knowing you don't fit the investment criteria. And, you know, I've been in investment rounds looking at other businesses and we've pulled out, but we've pulled out because there is something fundamentally wrong with the business and that somebody has told us something that isn't strictly true. And of course, then you're not going to invest on that basis. So, I mean, my experience out of this was the first question you ask someone who is looking to invest is, do we fit your criteria? And, you know, what is your expectation from this investment? Understand, question them to make sure that they are going to go the whole way. If you're sure that your business is sound, you've done all your due diligence, you know that, you know, you've paid for all your stock, that you know what your cash flow looks like, and that you are absolutely honest with them about your situation, then you're fine. And then it's just a case of them deciding whether it suits their appetite or not. But if it doesn't suit their investment criteria, just walk away.
And was there a little bit about learning to listen more to your gut instinct as well, Joanna, because you'd mentioned that you were concerned that you didn't fit their investment criteria and this had been playing on your mind, hadn't it, as this process was going on.
Yeah.
So after this happened, did you think, well, actually, I have got good instincts and maybe I should listen to them more?
Do you know, totally. And you're absolutely right, James, because, you know, if it doesn't smell right, you're not feeling it in your waters, as it were. Walk away. And I think, again, we need to collectively rely on our gut instinct a lot more. I didn't particularly like the individual. And that if you cannot go into a long-term relationship, and I know that a lot of young entrepreneurs these days think it's a 5-year process. It's not. You're probably looking 10 to 15 years. And to have a relationship with someone who you don't actually like for that period of time is going to be immensely stressful and very challenging. So, I mean, again, if you don't like them, don't do it.
And you mentioned that this period coincided with strife in your personal life, so you're going through a divorce. I think you also had a health scare around this time, didn't you? I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that. And then I also just wondered how you sort of managed to sort of keep the show on the road, really, given that, you know, you're trying to manage distress in the business, but then also all sorts of problems in your personal life. What sort of reserves did you draw on to just keep going, I suppose?
I think we're all a lot more capable than we think. And when we're put on the spot, I think, by and large, all of us have got reserves there that we never really tap into because it's easier to get someone else to do it or just throw in the towel. But when you're a mum and you've got two young children who are 100% your responsibility and rely on you from everything, from food to a roof over your head to their clothing, you've got to step up. And yeah, I was going through a divorce. My now ex-husband then took me to court, which was just unfathomable considering, you know, the house had pretty much been repossessed. So we lost our home, and this was all based after the 2008 downturn, and he lost his job and it was just a sort of catalogue of disaster. And so I knew I was going to be homeless. I had to find somewhere to live. We lost our investor. Throughout this time, I was feeling really not very well. And I was really struggling to eat because I had such pain in my stomach. And as it transpired, I had a massive fibroid, which is something that women can be prone to. And I, in fact, was very prone to it within their wombs. But mine had grown out of my womb and wrapped itself around my intestines and my appendix. And eventually, I was in so much agony, I went to go and see my private GP in London, and I said, I don't know what to do with myself. He rushed me for a scan, and then I was rushed in, and I had this 2.5 kilo tumour removed and was told you probably had about 10 days and it would have burst, and knowing what you're like, you'd have taken 2 paracetamol and gone to bed and you'd have never woken up. Or if I'd had made it to hospital, that have just taken everything out. So, I mean, you know, I carried on through all of this in quite intense pain, actually. But there was some good news amongst all of this period, in so much as I found my, as it were, forever investor. And throughout all of this, I mean, look, I knew I didn't have any money and I'm not proud. And when you're in that situation and you've run out of cash, don't sit there and think, oh, I'm not going to say anything because, you know, I'll put off my existing investors. You know, go out there. There are angel investors who specifically invest in distressed businesses. And I went straight to a broker who did this. And I went straight to him and I said, help. And he put me in touch with this forever investor, Andrew Leek, who was by trade a private equity investor. And he had is now doing private investment himself. And we met, and I always say he was the younger brother I never had. He was a highly intelligent, really gifted individual, still is, obviously. And he and I just gelled immediately. And that, you know, that importance of having an investor that you like, that you want to spend time with, don't underestimate that, but also one that delivers something to the party. And so Andrew was ex-Inflection, really understood about what you needed to take a business and get it ready for private equity or a trade sale. But also it was one of those classics. He would roll up his sleeves and got stuck in. I mean, poor sod. First 3 months, he ended up coming from Fulham down to Hampshire 3 times a week. And he was, in effect, our CFO and his COO. I mean, you know, the most he ever really got was a sandwich out of it. So, I mean, it was a really, 2014 was an absolutely shocking year, but I learned so much about myself. I learned so much about what people thought about the business and what people thought about our products. And I met someone who will be a friend for the rest of my life. And so, you know, I'm always, the glass is most definitely not even half full. It's always full, practically to overflowing. We have a choice. We can either lie down and give up, or we can say, sod this, I'm going to do, you know, you pick ourselves up, brush ourselves down and get on with it. And that's my mentality. I will always, you know, have a little weep, go to bed, get up in the morning and get up fighting. And, you know, two little girls are about the biggest motivation you need to get off your ass and get moving.
You built this without any background in branding, retail, consumer goods, things like that. But what about financial services? You had a successful career in the city before starting the company. Did that come in handy?
I think I was really lucky. And especially now when I see a lot of my female founders, it is understanding about a balance sheet, understanding about a P&L. These things are so, so, so important. And I didn't have to rely on a third party. I could do it all myself and I could understand it all myself. And I think, you know, I said to my girls, if you're not sure what you want to do, go and do an accountancy course. Just go and learn how to understand a balance sheet because it's so, so, so important. Saying that, I never had a business plan. I initially did it on the hoof and I had to do a business plan halfway, which is unforgivable for someone having worked in investment banking for as long as I had. But the other thing as well, which no one really talks about, is I'm a lot older than most entrepreneurs. I started this business when I was 40. And with age comes wisdom. And, you know, I don't want to sound like my mother, but it really does. And you understand the importance of having a commercial economic enterprise rather than a passion project. And it's getting that balance right. And it always was a commercial enterprise for me. I did this to make some money. And what I'm struggling with a bit now is pulling at the heartstrings, the fact that it's no longer mine. But you know, it was a means to an end and it did that. And I know that probably sounds really harsh, but that is what, you know, years of investment banking taught me. Yes, I'm passionate about it. And yes, I got emotional about it, but probably because I had so much at risk. So much at risk, and I would never recommend to anyone they put as much risk into their business as I did.
It's actually really refreshing to hear people talking that way, Joanna, and as you say, about like the fact that actually money is an important motivator and you do want to make money out of the business having put so much effort into it. And a lot of people seem to be shy about talking about that. I've never quite been sure why, but that's right.
And I think what we're going to see, sadly, over the course of the next year is a lot of people who, for no, I mean, who've got some brilliant products are going to struggle, who are really, really going to struggle. And that is, you know, simply because of the economic environment that we find ourselves in. But good products, good brands will out. They will keep going. And my advice to anyone who is struggling a bit is to just look at every penny that you're spending. And that one quick round circle is, what's my return on investment? Am I getting one? If I'm not, why am I doing it? And don't, whatever you do, start doing NPD right now. This is not the time. I actually spoke to someone the other day who's just invested a huge amount of money in NPD. And I said, that's fantastic. Who are you distributing it through? And they said, oh, no one. No one's taken it. And I just said, stop it right now, because you're tying up cash in stock that has no home. So now's the time to really take stock. Literally, what am I spending my money on? How long is it going to sit there? The best piece of advice my grandparents ever gave me was turnover, turnover, turnover. And that's what it's all about for the next 12 to 24 months.
And when you got your new investor in, what tangible difference? I mean, it's a bit more than an investor, maybe really a sort of business partner and, as you said, friend. What sort of tangible differences did that make to the business that then put you on the path that, of course, led to a successful trade sale a few years later on? What tangible differences and changes were made to the company that set it on this growth trajectory?
I mean, being a CEO and being a founder is a really lonely space because you can't talk to your employees about what's really going on. Well, you can and you can't, but you don't want to frighten people and you also want to attract the best talent that you can. And the last thing that they want to hear is that you're down to your last 50p. So not only did Andrew, and through his network, bring in some other investors as well. So he brought in capital, but he also brought in this real sort of sense around, I mean, I'm a huge risk taker. I will, you know, seat of your pants kind of gal. And Andrew wasn't. So we had balance. And actually one of his other investors, Paul Cartmell, who was he was a god of marketing, also came in, and the three of us basically ran that business together. And we had balance. So I was one end, Andrew was the other, and literally Paul was slap bang in the middle, but with this brilliantly experienced marketeer. And it brought structure. You know, just the simple fact of having a board meeting once a month meant that you were having to report on your activity. You were having to look at what you were spending your money on. You were having to ask, if we're going to spend this in marketing, what's our return on investment? And making people think, actually, do you know what? I could spend 10 grand and I could get nothing back. Actually, I'm not going to do it. But it brought structure. It brought debate. And it brought camaraderie. We were all in it together. And I desperately needed that because I'd felt like I was on my own. And I was battling all these battles on my own. And I was knackered.
You mentioned marketing there. And obviously you've built a very successful brand, a very successful children's skincare brand. For anyone listening who's trying to build a consumer brand business, what tips have you got? What have you learned about doing that?
Oh, wow. Well, we were... Look, looking at the market as it is now, which is so digitally driven, and how, you know, all these operators, be that social media, be that Google, are asking for an awful lot of money, and you're never really sure what you're going to get out of it. We launched in a market which was billboards and print magazines, and it was a very different. So it was advertising in its truest, oldest style. As we launched the products, really. And not forgetting, I'm just going to go back a stage, not forgetting the transit van moments that I had trekking around all of the country, going to school fairs, country shows, trade shows, consumer shows. I mean, literally, me and my transit van were the best friends, because what was so important for me was my consumer. At the heart of everything we did was our consumer. How can I make her life better as I made my own life better by actually having a product that helped my daughter's poorly skin? So telling that message is much more compelling if it comes from another mum, dad, parent, whoever, who has said, yeah, this stuff really works. And so for any product that anyone is creating, you know, it is so much more compelling if someone does your storytelling for you, because they have no axe to grind, they're not on the payroll. And I felt that for babies and children's skin and poorly skin, this is something that is, you know, you cannot get this wrong. And you've got to have people telling those compelling stories. We did TV as well. And I would say to anyone out there, don't underestimate the value of TV. It really does. And radio. I think it does make a profound difference to what you're doing. But the thing for us was brand in hand. And we did sampling like you wouldn't believe. Little bottles. And we were giving them away to people who went to the NCT nearly new sales, to baby shows, I'd have a box of them in the back of my car. You know, I remember driving past the pond in Barnes and I saw a woman with three little children. I stopped the car and I said, oh, hi, you know, you don't know me. I'm a total stranger, but I've just seen you've got some little ones and I wonder whether I could just give you some of these products. And it was that kind of behaviour which... Again, if you read a textbook on marketing, it will tell you statistically how to do it. And I just think if you want to reach your consumer, you need to know your consumer. You need to spend as much time with your consumer as possible. When you're working for an SME or you're setting up a new business and you are really striving to reach that consumer, talk to them and understand what their touch points are. Don't do a theoretical approach at it. If you look at any successful FMCG businesses, because they've done something different, they've been disruptive. I mean, look at BrewDog. You know, look what they do. This is, you may not agree with what they're saying, but boy, they can get some headlines. So I would say to any marketeer out there, push yourself, go and sit in wherever you sell your products or products that are like it. If you're fairly new to some listings, go and talk to, we'd go up and talk to people who were, you know, shopping in Boots. I mean, why we didn't have restraining orders taken out on us, it's beyond me. But you'd go up to someone and they'd be in the baby aisle and they'd be looking at everything. And you'd introduce yourself and you'd sort of say, look, you know, I'm really sorry, but I want to understand why you've made that choice. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll sit and have a chat with you.
How do you sort of do that at scale though? Because obviously, when you come to the point where you sold the majority of the business, you were selling millions and millions of bottles every year. So how do you sort of keep in touch with your end customer once that, you know, the business has become something quite substantial?
Well, that's not for me to say now, because all the operational side that Piso Cousins operate with Childs Farm, I have no involvement with at all. They are going back to our basics. They are saying, right, how are we going to do this? And, you know, it's really interesting. They're looking backwards to go forward. And I think that's fantastic. I think that's fantastic. But also they've got huge amounts of experience that we never had. We were doing everything seat of your pants 9 times out of 10. And these guys have been doing it man and boy. They know what they're doing and they know how to get the word out there. But they are, what I would say, and I'm really impressed by it, they're taking a holistic view. They are looking at what we've done in the past that's been successful. They're looking at what they do for other brands. I have to say, you know, that's what you want when you sell your business still with a stake in it. Someone who's not going to be, this is the way we do it, so there. And it's time to go back to basics. And it's time to look at all of those alternative ways of reaching your consumer. Don't feel, and I spend a lot of time working with female-founded brands at the moment, don't feel that digital is the only way, because it's not. It really isn't. And there are other ways to get it. But I think, you know, I look at the way we grew our business as we built some really solid foundations and we kept on building on that. And we got that message around the UK really clearly through our brand ambassadors. So we had a group of mums, dads and caregivers who were absolutely dotty about the brand because their own experience had been like mine. Oh my God, my child who's had eczema for however many years. I mean, their skin is fantastic. They are not crying. They are not complaining. We've made a manifold difference. Plus we had adults who were using the product too, who had phenomenal experiences with it. So we had that a part of it. But when I go back to talking about these stories, your consumer says for you, we had two points in the lifestyle of this brand, one in 2016, one in 2017. 2016, and Paige Sweeney, her little girl, she just showed a picture of her hands once before using Childs Farm and one 2 weeks later. And they went from red, raw and angry to perfect in 2 weeks. And that Facebook post, before Facebook had monetized it, was shared 35,000 times in the first month. And again, when lovely Laura Gray shared her post, baby moisturizer, she just showed a photograph of our baby moisturizer saying, my mother bought me this, it cured my psoriasis in 24 hours. That was shared 65,000 times. We sold 1.5 million quid's worth of baby moisturizer in a week. And bearing in mind, it was £4. That's a lot of baby moisturizer. And we were the right place for digital then. To do that now, you would have to spend an absolute fortune. And it wouldn't have the authenticity. I mean, we didn't even know what was going on. Suddenly our shop went mad. You know, we were having to sit there saying, well, what's going on? And it was a lot of head scratching and a lot of confusion and a lot of ignorance. But we got there in the end. And God, it was exciting. I mean, really, really, really exciting. And that's why you do this. Those moments of madness. I would love to say it was organised chaos. It wasn't. It was total chaos. And again, our contract manufacturer played a bloody blinder. They were there all night. They were open at weekends. They were there to support us, which is that importance of that relationship is so key. If it hadn't been for them, we wouldn't have been able to monetize it the way that we did. But Tom rallied the troops and they were all as excited as we were. You know, all of our componentry suppliers were excited as we were. One wasn't. They were no longer our componentry suppliers 6 months later because they just said, oh, we can help you in about 6 months' time. We're really busy. But everyone else was just going, oh my God, this is so exciting. And it was just like a wave that we all, you know, we ran around holding hands, you know, high-fiving each other as we worked probably 22 hours a day for about 3 months.
Given the obvious enjoyment you got from building the business, which is coming across very clearly, can you talk me through why you decided to sell the majority of it last year?
Oh, good question. I think, look, I've got two young girls and they're now teenagers. They're 14 and nearly 17. And as your children get older, they need you an awful lot more. And sadly, my poor mama's got dementia and Alzheimer's. And we'd always said to my shareholders, we were aiming to sell around 2020. And of course, COVID hit. And COVID was exhausting, I think, for absolutely everyone, as we all know, on so many different levels. And we knew that, I knew that I had to make a change. We also wanted to grow the brand, and we felt we collectively didn't have that level of skill set, and we needed a partner who could help us grow internationally, particularly the US. But also, we hadn't really done much in Europe, which was very lucky when Brexit happened. But we had done Australia, and running Australia from here was a nightmare because of the different time zones. And so there was huge opportunities for Childs Farm. We knew there was. We do sell it all over the world anyhow, but we just felt we needed experience and know-how to get us to that next stage. And actually, we were looking for private equity investment to take us there. And I'd brought in Will Bowler as my CEO. He had done Pop Chips prior to that. And the plan was he was then going to grow the business and get a team to build it with private equity investment. But out of left field came PZ Cousins. And I know it sounds really cheesy, but we literally, that first meeting, we all sort of fell in love. And it suited their strategy so well because they wanted to grow in baby and child really badly. And they've got a great business in Indonesia, which is baby. And they wanted to do more in the UK and Europe. And it just, all the stars aligned. And it worked for me. It worked for some of my team. Some of them have been there slogging their hearts out for, I mean, my head of sales had been there for 6 years and he literally had never been on holiday. And my investors, I had 26 investors and they were looking to get their money out. So it really worked. I think we found a fantastic partner in PZ Cousins. I'm still there for another 2.5 years, not on the operational side, but helping and advising where it's required. And also, you know, helping to promote female entrepreneurism as well, which is so underfunded in this country, as you know.
Did you have any concerns about selling to an established, fast-moving consumer goods business, given it feels like Childs Farm has very much had the feel of a challenger brand, and in terms of the contents of what it's made from, right down to where the goods are sourced from and everything, it's all about sort of quality, trust, provenance, all those kind of things. Sometimes things that people don't associate with larger businesses. So did you have any concerns about, I guess, diluting the quality of the brand by selling to a large established business in your space rather than private equity?
I mean, there's no two ways about it. Look, Childs Farm is an extension of me. It is all of my values and principles when it comes to natural origin ingredients around sustainability. You know, our plastic is sourced from Indonesia, which is ocean prevented plastic. So it creates a social economic environment for them, but it also makes sure that this plastic is reused. We've been ahead of the game in that category of our competitors for years. And also we're a B Corp. But part of the appeal of PZ Cousins, and only PZ Cousins, and actually we did have other trade interested, the appeal was they take their sustainability incredibly seriously. And their global sustainability officer, another Joanna, totally understands what she's trying to achieve for that business. They have aspirations to become a B Corp themselves. They totally understood what they wanted to do. And they were so honest and not proud. I mean, there isn't arrogance about, you know, big businesses, you know. They were really honest and they were saying, we want to learn from you because, yeah, it's easier for us to do it because our volumes are nothing compared to some of theirs. But they want to learn how we did it and see what we did that they can use for themselves. So, you know, we struck gold with PZ Cousins, actually. I don't think there is another big organisation like that that would have had that sustainability element, which was so super key to me.
What's next for you then, Joanna? So you mentioned you're on an earnout for about 2.5 years, and it sounds like you're already busy working with other female entrepreneurs. What's the plan for you? What's your next big ambition?
Well, I mean, just right now, I'm doing what I need, what's required of me by PZ, which is great. I am working with a wonderful organisation called BWB, which is By Women Built. And this was set up by Sahar Hashimi and Barney McCauley. about raising awareness of female-founded brands who are wholly underinvested in. I mean, if we had as much investment as male-founded brands, it's another $250 billion to the economy. So I'm working with this great group of consumer brands, all female-founded, which is allowing me to A, mentor some of them, B, give them all of those shortcuts that I never had, but also allowing me to invest in other female-founded brands, which I'm really, really enjoying because this is something that I'm loving doing. I'm also supporting a couple of charities which I adore, and we always have Riding for the Disabled and Paralympics. I am thinking that maybe I need to write a book about my top tips and experiences from SONCG because I think, again, I kind of say it how it is. I don't sugarcoat things. You know, it was bloody hard. I wasn't the easiest person to work for, but there are reasons for that. And I think most founders would agree that those are sort of similar things. I most definitely did this for the money. I had two small children that I had to look after, and I bet everything I had on this. And, you know, I've been told that, you know, why do I need the money? I've got so many plums in my mouth and all the rest of it. Never judge a book. The world is a garden in which many different flowers grow, and we're all so different. And as you said earlier, nobody knows anyone's backstory. Nobody really knows what's going on. So there's all of that that I sort of kind of want to sort of vomit with some structure onto a few pages. So hopefully that helps other people. And really, I think the new life for me when I am free is going to be all around investment and being an NED in some of these organizations, SMEs, because I think the more that those that have one in that space can help others will go a long way to filling that economic gap. And the British have always been a nation of entrepreneurs. And, you know, in spite of COVID and in spite of Brexit and in spite of an economic downturn, we need to keep going. We need to not allow ourselves to lose this brilliance that we have as a nation. And I mean, there is still, you know, at the moment as well, with everything post-COVID, people are sort of a bit down in the mouth. And, you know, I know so many businesses are struggling to hire the right people, people who've got energy, people who've got desire, people who've got get up and go. We need to make sure that that happens. And people like myself and other entrepreneurs who you've had on this program, we need to, this is our giving back. We go out and we make sure this happens, whether it happens in the UK or whether it happens internationally. But my focus is female founders in the UK, and I want them to flourish and fly, and I'll do anything in my power to make that so.
Well, it sounds like there's more than enough there to keep you very busy. But one final question, would you ever start your own business again?
Oh, never say never. But right now, I'm loving spending more time with my kids. You know, mum needs me desperately at the moment, not forgetting my boyfriend. He'll get cross if I don't mention him. I don't know. Mimi and I, who's my eldest, we talk about it a lot. She's going to do something. And I think we'll probably do something together. That's my hope. That's my real hope. And I think that would be a hoot. I think that would be a hoot. I think it would be extremely argumentative. But I think it would be an awful lot of fun too.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Joanna. And thanks for being so frank. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, thank you, James. I've really enjoyed being on it.
Joanna, thanks so much for your time and for being part of such an honest conversation. Some really fascinating food for thought there for entrepreneurs of all stripes, I thought. And next time, I'll be chatting to an entrepreneur of a very different sort and a very different industry, Samir Desai, founder and chief executive of Superpayments.
You know, there were businesses like Square and PayPal, and they were starting to encroach on the loans business that we had. And I was trying to work out why they were making so much money. I kind of had this assumption that money was free. Like, I thought when you pay someone in a shop £10, £20, that's what someone gets. And then I just started going into it and looking at like how the money moved and where it all went. But it just felt crazy to me. Like, it just didn't make sense. And it just blew my mind that there's trillions of dollars of market cap in payments.
Just click the follow button wherever you listen to this right now to be notified when that and all future episodes are available. Until next time, goodbye.
Does running a business leave little time for managing your personal financial affairs? At Kleinwort Hambros, we know how to simplify life's financial challenges for entrepreneurs. Considering your personal and business ambitions, we partner with you at every stage of your life, taking care of your finances so you can focus on what matters most to you. Find out more about how we can help create a secure financial future for you and your family at climewatthambros.com.